This is Future Water, where we talk about all the ways in which companies, utilities, and people are addressing challenges and opportunities in water. Today, we're going to talk about water infrastructure, regulations, and politics. A new administration is in the door, in the U.S., that is, and we're already seeing changes happening from climate to water quality. The outlook for change is positive, that is, depending on your perspective. So, not to be forgotten, however, are the headwinds that we currently face: COVID, municipal budgets, and employment, all of which are driving spending, stimulus, .. So first, let's kick it off with some news and takes. As you may already know, some of these are already delivered through Bluefield's Waterline newsletter. Every Wednesday, we send it out. News, hot takes, charts of the month, data of the week, podcast, webcast invitations. Sometimes you might get a report discount. So sign up. You can do that at bluefieldresearch.com. So I got three items for you today. At the end of January, the Congressional PFAS Task Force was relaunched and sent a letter to President Joe Biden in which 132 members of Congress from both parties urged immediate steps to tackle the contamination problem. And it cited an advocacy group, or at least an advocacy group's data, that more than 200 million Americans are likely drinking water that contains at least trace levels of PFAS chemicals. So they are planning to relaunch the task force. According to our report from Bluefield, PFAS, the next challenge for water utilities, more than $3 billion is forecasted to be spent annually on drinking water remediation technologies by 2030. So it will ramp up. It's happening at the state level. In fact, New Hampshire, I think just last week I read, maybe even this week, that they were allocating $50 million to enable utilities or cities to do testing. Hopefully I'm not way off the mark on that one. So things are happening with PFAS, and it's probably going to ramp back up because it felt really strong, the wave or momentum in Q1 of 2020, but there was a distraction called the COVID pandemic that sort of ran things, and an election that's kind of took everybody's eye away from the ball, but we seem to be heading back in that direction. Take two, or news item two: as of late January, 93% of Nevada, the state of, is in either severe or exceptional drought, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. In December, the Bureau of Reclamation predicted that for the first time, Lake Mead's water levels would go below 1,075 feet. And that is a bad sign because it's a benchmark for Colorado water management and strategies related to it. The Bureau's predictions mean that more cuts will be coming to two Colorado compact states, Nevada and Arizona. I think it feels a little strange given that the Sierra's got about 9 feet of snow this past week. But what it does tell me also is that there's definite, I'm going to call it chronic gun shyness. Gun shyness, if that's a word, is extending from the last drought in California or in the western U.S. I know a lot of these are desert states, but they do in fact go through drought. And a lot of people live there. They do need water. So separately, the increasing financial investor interest in water in the West does pose a real challenge to the status quo because, one, they can move faster than regulators. Two, money talks. And I'm not sure, in fact, if this is a good thing, but I can say this, the current situation is not any good either. So they're going to invest, own water rights. They're already buying them. And so that makes for us at Bluefield, what are the solutions on the back end to either better manage or better use, reuse water sources and supplies? There's a lot of opportunity there. And the financial community may be the spark that the Western U.S. needs. Number three, and related to another kind of water stress. In fact, I'm just going to call it water scarcity. Look to the Middle East. Doosan Heavy Industries and Construction Company just landed a $7 million deal to build the Yanbu 4 seawater desal plant in Saudi Arabia. Partners include on Xi, who's also been in the news for selling his 29.9% stake in Suez to Veolia, but also Saudi Arabian firms Moa and Nesma. Doosan has also landed in recent years, since 2016, projects in Kuwait, others in Saudi Arabia, Oman. So what this tells us is, one, they continue to be busy. I mean, Doosan has been a real player in this market for a while, but they're also capitalizing on the ongoing shift towards reverse osmosis applications and technology, which continues to grow and displace more traditional, if you will, thermal technologies in desal, particularly in the Middle East. So, I mean, according to our analysis at Bluefield, we put out a report on large-scale desalination technology trends or adoption rates and net ownership stakes among the leading players in desalination, and RO, or reverse osmosis, has made up 58% of total capacity additions since 1999. The other not so hot take is that private participation in Saudi Arabia is taking off or moving forward. And I know that some of my colleagues have been working on some wastewater reuse market analysis in the GCC region. And I know that part of that has been a discussion about Saudi Arabia, or let me take that back, the participation of private firms in wastewater. So I haven't seen the draft yet, but I suspect that's where the market is ultimately heading, because desal is the most expensive water out there, definitely reliable and a good source, but wastewater reuse is another opportunity for lower cost water because you're already treating it in most cases. So there you have it. A couple of takeaways from this week, or maybe the last 2 weeks, since we do this every 2 weeks. To keep up on the news, Bluefield analysis, and upcoming webcast and data, sign up for Waterline, as I mentioned. You can also just go to bluefieldresearch.com and check out what's happening. And now I'm going to transition or shift over to my colleagues to talk about what's happening with the new administration in Washington. All right, the transition has happened and the Biden honeymoon seems to be coming to an end, I think. And a couple of Bluefield analysts have been thinking about the impacts on water and wastewater for municipal and industrial sectors. So today I'm joined by Aaron Bonnie Casey and Cullen Mitchell. Cullen, how goes it?
Going well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, I mean, we do talk every day, so I appreciate your enthusiasm. Aaron, how are you?
Good. Good morning, or good afternoon, depending on when you're listening to this.
All right. So guys, one of the ongoing discussion we've been having is, and actually we had this well before even the election, was what would happen or what will happen if a new administration comes in. And in this case, it's not just the executive branch, meaning the White House, but also the legislative branch. So the Democrats now have control of the White House and somewhat of a control of Congress, both House and Senate. So it seems a little quiet these days, but things are happening in Washington. So Aaron, you lead the Municipal Water Insight Service, among other things. So any top-line takeaways from recent announcements that you've been hearing out of Washington?
Yeah, I mean, there are a few things that I've been paying attention to. So first, and you know, it speaks to exactly what you were talking to, Reese. When we were talking pre-election, we were kind of thinking through scenarios. We at Bluefield always said that the best case scenario for getting an infrastructure stimulus bill is if Democrats had control of both houses of Congress and the presidency. And so we're increasingly optimistic that we're going to see at some point over the Biden administration an infrastructure stimulus bill. We already see through some of the executive orders that Biden's been issuing over the past couple of weeks that he's really focused on climate and infrastructure and catalyzing the creation of jobs. within construction through environment and climate related projects. And so, you know, we see water as fitting kind of perfectly into that niche. We know there's a huge unmet need for infrastructure funding and upgrades in the water system. And so, you know, we're kind of tentatively optimistic that that conversation is going to actually turn into dollars in the somewhat near term. I will say the kind of caveat or my hesitation around that is we have been burned in the past. We've been talking about infrastructure stimulus or spending coming out of Congress for years, and it's never materialized. And also, I think COVID is definitely still the number one priority in Washington. So, you know, I think we're not going to see the real conversation shift to infrastructure until at least after the pandemic is over. Another thing that I've been paying attention to is the Biden administration issuing that memo that halted all of the Trump administration rules that haven't gone into effect yet. And specifically in, you know, my space in municipal water, I'm looking at the lead and copper rule. So for those of you not intimately following the lead and copper rule revisions, the Trump administration approved a revision to the rule that would reduce the required replacement rates of lead service lines to only 3% per year, which if you do the math means they're going to end up taking over 30 years to replace all of those lead service lines. Previously, the rule had said you have to replace 7% a year, so it cuts that timeline in half. So that rule's been suspended now, and so I wouldn't be surprised if the EPA revisited once again and sped that timeline back up to get those lead pipes replaced.
I would think, you know, one of the things, so our colleague Mariel Marchand and I, we wasn't an argument last week, but on the lead and copper rule, she was pushing back, saying, actually, is it really making that much of a difference? Because it's really changing the timeline. But then there's also the stipulation or the understanding that once the municipality or the utility, once they've identified the problem, if it is in fact a problem, then it needs to be dealt with immediately, meaning they've got to begin immediately. So there is some upside and downside to both of the orders or rules, rule amendments. You know, I think they also, is it 60 days they have to review those policies?
Yeah, that's right. And you know, lead and copper, this is one of those things that we've known has been a problem for decades now. And
I mean, decade, almost a half a century.
Yeah. And the real problem is that utilities, once they know it's an issue, they still have to figure out how to pay for those replacement programs. So it again comes down to, is there going to be any money to support those efforts?
Yeah. And I think also related to Congress is, you know, state and local funding. I know that's a big sticking point over any stimulus discussions. Now, how much of that actually goes to things like, you know, dealing with lead and copper? Because you're exactly right. I think a lot of the lead problems, if you will, they're inside the fence, meaning they're not necessarily in the utility network as we see it. And so is there utility really going to have to pay for this? I mean, what are we saying? $2,000 to $2,500 per household or per project. So if that's in fact the case, then, you know, who is going to pay for it? The rate payer, the individual household, the city, or is the federal government ultimately going to have to step in? Now, if they do have to do it, there are big jobs. I think they're big jobs. You know, who benefits from that? It would be obviously the contractors or the people who have to come in and replace lines. But there's also an opportunity, as I mentioned, I think with Dave McGimsey on his recent podcast, and that is this all has to be inventoried as well, like figuring out where the problems are. And there are some smarter digital solutions. I think that's where we put companies like 120 Water. There are a couple others out there that are doing that. It's interesting. So that's kind of the quick municipal take. Cullen, you focus on industrials. What's your take?
Yeah, so the Biden administration's kind of commitment to climate change, I think, is going to have really big impacts throughout his campaign. And now we're seeing the beginnings of with some of his executive actions. He's had kind of two main targets, one being to decarbonize the power sector by 2035. And another is to put the U.S. on a path to net zero emissions economy-wide across all sectors by 2050. Those are kind of in line with Paris Agreement countries, you know, a lot of the OECD countries. So I think trends that we see in the US will also be happening globally. And that really means a shift in the power sector, a shift away from more water intensive fuels like coal and natural gas, towards more renewables like wind and solar, but also nuclear power and green hydrogen. We've seen Biden already. He put a freeze on new drilling for oil and natural gas on federal lands. And he's also committed to procuring more electric vehicles for the federal fleet, which I will say is a bit of an uphill battle. There's something like 600,000 vehicles in the federal fleet total. And most recent data on that in 2019, only about 0.5% of those vehicles were electric. So a bit of a challenge. So those are really ambitious goals. I think they're not going to be easy to meet. And so we'll see big changes and ripple effects throughout the economy and into water, especially. One note about power, I would say natural gas is the least carbon intensive fuel source. So I think when we're talking about getting to net zero by 2035, we're still going to see a lot of natural gas alongside carbon capture and storage technologies. So the power sector will continue to be pretty water intensive, although that is going down. Another sector we're looking at though for water is mining. So for electric vehicle batteries, batteries that store renewable energy, and even the solar PV technology, those all require a lot of metals, including lithium, cadmium, and cobalt. And so to achieve those climate targets, we're going to really need to ramp up mining for those metals. And so when we're talking about the Biden administration re-implementing old environmental regulations or implementing all new ones, I think the mining sector might get overlooked, at least for the time being. So the pandemic has really reinforced this need for a secure supply chain. And right now, China owns a lot of the market share for these metals. So we're looking to a lot more domestic mining in the US. And given a lot of the water scarcity challenges that a lot of the US is experiencing, we're looking to more investment in reuse, sourcing of wastewater for mining processes as well. And lastly, I'll say there is a kind of a tension that we're looking at in the Biden administration between their commitment to environmental justice and new regulation to protect communities from pollution, and balancing that with this need for ramping up more water polluting industries like mining. So it'll be interesting to see how he balances that.
Yeah, I mean, I think something is going to have to give, right? There's always a trade-off for all of this, right? So in a perfect world, we would say, oh, everything's going to go to wind, to solar, everything's going to be clean, neat, and tidy. But the reality of it is, in order to support some of those industries, you need to do mining, right? So maybe, I think we talked about this the other day, is maybe mining gets a little bit of a pass, right? So for coal to basically disappear or be removed from the existing power generation fleet, that's a tall order too. So that's partly happened because of natural gas. So, you know, environmentalists can complain about natural gas all they want, but maybe it's ultimately been a stepping stone away from coal, right? It's basically been, let's go coal to natural gas, which now there's an abundance of in the US because of fracking. And then the next step is, along the way, we've been building up wind and solar. And now is the next step, electric power powered by solar and wind, but also by hydrogen. Hydrogen, is that the next step that we see? I think you and I, have we already talked about a podcast on that, or definitely we put some research out on it?
Yeah, we have a research note and we did a podcast episode about that at the end of last year.
Sorry, I'm getting clouded. Aaron, do you have anything to add to that?
I would just say, when you're talking about regulation too, on the industrial sector, there's a lot of chatter right now about what's going to happen with the Waters of the US rule. So the backstory of that being, essentially the Obama administration expanded the definition of which water bodies the Clean Water Act applied to. It meant that a lot more industrial and agricultural facilities were going to come under regulation. The Trump administration rolled that back. The Biden administration obviously supports the Obama era kind of expansion of that. Now it's kind of caught up in the courts. And so it'll be interesting to see what the push and pull of that is. And, you know, the ultimate resolution would be if Congress steps in and officially expands the application of the Clean Water Act. And that would impact all of these industrial users, that they would have to clean their effluent more.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's helpful. And I think I see all of this, quite honestly, I'm trying to put an optimistic spin on it. And I think there's clearly opportunity, right? I mean, you could say that the solar industry is terrible, for instance, whether you agree with it or not, it's added a lot of jobs in the US. I mean, you need installers, and you can't do that with robots, and you can't do it with software. People need to go out there, whether it be install now low-cost solar panels, whether it be in large farms in Arizona, Nevada, or Texas, but also on people's homes. It takes people to do that. So there are real jobs there. It's also something that is local and can be controlled, whereas honestly, oil, natural gas, less so. Oil is obviously a global commodity and not necessarily used for power generation. Gas, increasingly so with liquefied natural gas and shipping and moving it around. So I think there's an opportunity there. And also for hydrogen. And as we talk about water, what does that mean for water? Any of these shifts, you know, when you shut down a coal facility, there's got to be remediation. Someone's got to deal not only with coal ash that's been set to the side of the facility, but also the mines themselves. So there are treatment and opportunities for the water sector and solutions providers. The other is, as we move to hydrogen. Hydrogen is a large water user if we, in fact, get there. I'm not 100% sure that's going to happen. It's still costly. It's going to take a little while, but there's a lot of supply needs, but also on the back end as well. So, and it's got to be clean or ultra pure. So, well, Cullen, when it comes to the climate, I mean, it sounds like the implications are wide sweeping. I could talk forever on this myself, but one area that I know you've been looking at is, and related to the Biden administration, is on electric or alternative fuel vehicles. What does that mean for water?
Yeah, so I think even absent a new administration, EVs, market forces were kind of pushing electric vehicles to be a larger share of the market, though the new administration will certainly help. And that really does cause shifts in water management and automotive assembly. So just a couple trends to point out. GM has said that they plan to go all electric by 2035, and Volkswagen says that they will only sell hybrids or EVs by 2025. So this is coming pretty quickly. And then Tesla, as they've announced and have broken ground on, are building a new assembly plant in Texas outside of Austin. So this shift towards more EVs means a lot of new assembly plants and also retrofitting of old assembly plants. So that creates an opportunity to invest in capital improvements for new water treatment trains for these facilities or brand new facilities. But then also, I think the siting and the location of these facilities is really interesting. So the one in Tesla's in Texas, for example, in an area experiencing lots of population growth, but also water scarcity, really opens up the opportunity for investing in new reuse technologies and figuring out ways to use less water, but that usually means spending more on water.
So, Aaron, I mean, outside of, you've looked at this partly through corporate sustainability, but looking at these public traded companies, I mean, most of them have set goals. I mean, I think that is one thing about the auto sector. It is very consumer facing, if you will. It's not all government fleets. I mean, the Super Bowl is when in a couple of days. So we're going to get plenty of auto ads thrown in our faces. I'm certain of that. So any thoughts on sort of the corporate sustainability end of things?
Yeah, I mean, to Colin's point, I think corporate sustainability goals is another factor that's outside of regulation that's changing the automotive supply chain landscape. And so we've been looking at, you know, large automotive manufacturers. And for example, 9 out of the top 10 have set water use reduction standards. And actually that outlier is Tesla. And they've actually done the best in terms of reducing water usage over the past few years. They just haven't set a target. And I think there's a few reasons that they're trying to reduce water. One, to your point, Reese, they are consumer facing. They are trying to up their green marketing campaigns, make the point to consumers that they are kind of conscientious consumers of natural resources. The other factor is there are cost savings associated with reducing water. Most automotive companies are purchasing water from municipal systems. So as those rates go up, so do their input costs. And reducing water usage is a way of controlling that, bringing it back inside the fence.
Can we also assume, I mean, you talk about water supply, and we've looked at that data where those, I'd say 10 companies specifically, I mean, those are the market movers. They're supplying or sourcing from municipal supplies. And look, it's not like the automotive sector uses, you know, vast amounts of water, particularly relative to pulp and paper or the power sector for that matter. But they are using it for the facility usage for toilets and taps and showers and such. But then it's also used in cooling for the plants and facilities as well as in the paint shop. If they're drawing so much from the municipal supply, we can assume that actually they're discharging to the municipal wastewater system as well?
Yeah, I think you can make that assumption, just because if they're located within a municipal drinking water network, 99% chance they're also located within a sewer network. And so as municipalities are going to start tightening the stuff that you can discharge to the sewer or increasing surcharges for dirty water put in the sewer, it's another cost that the automotive companies are going to have to bear.
Yeah. So I think that's why some research we've been doing recently, and I know that's another thing that's pending on our end, and that is the deployment of things like water or wastewater reuse, zero liquid discharge at a number of different facilities. We even saw Cullen at Tesla, I think they even have a patent for wastewater treatment technology that they filed a couple of years ago, and whether that's related to their existing facilities, because they've got certain types of contaminants or constituents, I don't know if I'd call them contaminants, that are in their wastewater that they feel like, hey, we can just deal with this ourselves. I'm correct on that, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So Aaron, when it comes to changing gears, when it comes to like the administration, let's sort of go full circle. What about the leadership changes? Does that tell us anything? I remember when the Trump administration came in, I mean, it's been so long now, but you remember there were people from, whether it be lobbyists or the coal industry, coming in to head Department of Energy, right? So what does that mean for the Biden administration? Are we seeing something different, although just from the other end of the spectrum?
Yeah. So, I mean, we've been paying attention to kind of the changes at the EPA, because I think that's going to have the biggest impact on the water space in particular. So the EPA chief, Michael Reagan, I think he was confirmed by now, but
I think he's being interviewed right now.
He's still in the nominee. All right. You know, for one thing, he has a strong background in environmental regulation, which is a shift from what we saw previously. That's not a surprise for the Biden administration. For sure, he's going to take a proactive stance on tightening regulation. I think one really interesting thing with him, you know, individually, is that he is one of the few people in the country that has experience with PFAS. When he was working in North Carolina, he worked on an agreement with Chemours to stop the pollution of drinking water in the state with PFAS. And we know that this is an emerging contaminant of concern. There's a lot of regulatory discussion about what to do about PFAS. And so we expected that those regulations were going to evolve and tighten in the coming years. And I think his appointment just stresses that it will be a focus of the new EPA. There's also a fair amount of excitement over the appointment of Radhika Fox to lead the EPA's Office of Water. So she was the former CEO of US Water Alliance. She's really been out front in the industry talking about policy and the need for water investments. And I know within the EPA, there's a sense that there's going to be a lot of activity over the next few years under that leadership.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think that'll be, like I said, I think we started this, the Biden administration still feels to be like it's in a bit of a honeymoon period, but I think that's going to come to an end if it hasn't already. These new appointees, I mean, definitely the EPA, and I just know conversations with even our friends or even, you know, just talking with people that we know at the EPA, I think morale there could use a little bit of a boost. And if that's a step in the right direction, then great. I get it. I think when it comes to regulations, people are concerned. But at the same time, you know, the EPA, a lot of what they do pushes down to the state level. And so a lot of the final or ultimate decisions, including PFAS, right, is happening at the state level thus far. So I think there was even news from New Hampshire the other day about setting aside money for PFAS. I don't know if it was testing or just evaluation. All right. Well, with that being said, guys, thanks for stepping up, and look forward to catching up with you soon. Before I let you go, Aaron, is there anything you're working on right now that might be of interest?
Yeah, you know, you guys talked about the automotive sector. That's going to be coming out soon. I think that'll be really interesting for our industrial clients. We're also working on our municipal OPEX forecast, which I'm really excited about, and that will be coming out later this month. And that'll be, I think, really interesting for our municipal clients.
What about you, Colin?
So I'm also working on a research note kind of tying in with Aaron's automotive research on Tesla's work in Texas, and then also starting to look into water management for the food and beverage industry.
And also, I might add, I think everybody's working on it. We have a webcast coming up, definitely for clients and others. It is on, I can't remember exactly what the title is. I guess I should know. It's basically about data. What, you know, what does the data tell us in water for the research team? So I know the team has put together a number of data sets and it's going to demonstrate that to attendees of the webcast about what it tells us, but also what are the trends to look forward to in using that data. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, absolutely. Data underpins all of our research. And so we're excited to share that with clients and some of the data that we're looking at and how we get to our conclusions.
Okay. All right, guys. Well, that's a wrap. So thanks again and be well. Before we sign off, to anybody who's downloaded this, please subscribe. Just one click of the button. Give us a review. Another click of the button. You don't even have to say anything on, you know, I've been calling it iTunes for, I think, since we started this podcast. Podcasts aren't even on iTunes anymore. No one's ever said anything to me until just the other day. I realized it's actually Apple Podcasts. So I'm coming into the 21st century here. So give us a review on Apple Podcasts. You can't do it on Spotify and all the other platforms in which we're posting this podcast. So separately, and maybe thirdly, send us a note if you're interested in any particular topic. You can always reach us at waterexperts@bluefieldresearch.com. Any topic ideas are always good to hear. And I don't know, I assume you guys all have friends. Everybody needs a friend, needs to talk to someone these days. So tell them about the future of water, particularly if they're in the water industry or interested in it. All right. This podcast and these water industry insights have been brought to you by Bluefield Research. To learn more about us and what it all is, go to bluefieldresearch.com. Take care.